We are joined live here in the studios by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome back, Maria.
Yeah, thank you.
Good to have you back.
Yeah. Head cold is mostly cleared up, but I might have to clear my throat a few times.
All right.
We will swap out the microphone after you're done.
We will take it outside and burn it.
I'm not contagious anymore.
Oh, okay.
Just so you know.
Okay. Very good.
That's been a concern for years, actually.
Although I've heard people say that your laugh is contagious.
Well, I hope so.
Oh. Yes. Because we've got to laugh, given the material we cover.
Oh, yeah.
There we go. Yeah.
Got to get a good laugh out of it, at least.
Okay. Uh-huh. So let's give some examples of that. The material we cover, as opposed to laugh. Well, we can still do both. Starting out with local and University of Washington.
Yeah. A lot of Seattle folks were getting star turns in national media this week. That includes the UW Center for Human Rights head, Angela Godoy, I think it's how you pronounce her name. She was on CNN after she got sued by Cowlitz County on behalf of ICE because her research at the UW Center for Human Rights revealed secret ICE facilities in northern states, including Washington State down in Cowlitz County, that were essentially warehousing what ICE considered high-risk teens. Now, these are non-citizen teens who have not been convicted of any crime, but ICE considers them criminals for some reason. Maybe they have a tattoo ICE doesn't like or whatever.
Or maybe they just can't identify who their parents are.
Yeah, that's certainly a criminal offense.
Oh, yeah.
And something that ICE has a direct role in. But so ICE sued her, which is an odd move, but it does tell you the Trump administration's commitment to non-transparency.
They're actually suing her to prevent her from getting the list and information of the people in Cowlitz County.
Yes, so. And she's not trying to get names. She's just trying to get an understanding of how long people have been there, how many people are there, why they're being held. And ICE does not want to release any of that information. So so we're going to keep an eye on that story, definitely.
And and they were, the jail itself was going to give her the information. They were completely being compliant, so but ICE intervened. So.
Yes, exactly. So we'll keep an eye on that
developing story.
Yes.
All right. So also this week there has been many developments around the elections that are just days away now.
Yeah, I just wanted to give an update on the campaign financing. So financing that the candidates have raised for their own individual campaigns, so people have an idea of where the money levels are in the candidates' own campaigns versus the outside PAC funding.
Yeah, now, and I'll talk about the outside PAC funding in a minute.
Yeah. Now, the campaign financing in District 1, Lisa Herbold has raised $186,500. Phil Tavel has raised $177,500, so fairly close there. District 2, Tammy Morales has raised $180,800, and Mark Solomon is a ways behind her. He has raised $132,600, or thereabouts. In District 3, Shama Sawant has raised $419,800. That's more than double what a lot of the other candidates have raised.
And she's seen a lot of criticism for getting donations from outside Seattle, but she's gotten more District 3 donations than Orion by far.
Yeah, and she decided not to take democracy vouchers because she knew that whoever was going to be running against her was going to get a lot of money from the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, from Amazon, from other big businesses in Seattle. Her opponent, Egan Orion, has raised $380,300. So she was right about that.
Yeah.
Now, this is not talking about outside PAC money yet. We'll get to that in a minute. Now, in District 4, Sean Scott has raised $198,400 or thereabouts. Alex Peterson is right behind him with $192,600. So they're pretty neck and neck there in District 4.
It's interesting to me that the grassroots candidates in each of those districts so far has raised more money than their corporate opponents.
Yeah, it is interesting. But we're looking again at the financing that the candidates have raised themselves.
As opposed to the money that, say, Amazon dumped into
And remember, these grassroots candidates tend to have larger teams of volunteers going out, holding house parties for them, you know, collecting donations as well as canvassing for them. So that's one of the advantages that the grassroots candidates have over the more corporate-funded candidates. Now, in District 5, Deborah Juarez is far ahead of Ann Davison Sattler. Juarez has raised $149,600, and Sattler has raised about $64,500. So I don't think there's any question there of who's going to win that race. In District 6, Dan Strauss has raised... Heidi Wills is the leader in District 6. She's raised $225,600. Dan Strauss is a ways behind her with $186,300. In District 7, Jim Pugel is the leader there with $194,700, kind of flipping it. I think Lewis was the leader going into the primaries. Andrew Lewis has raised about $173,000.
And it's interesting. First of all, democracy vouchers were meant to level the playing field.
Yeah.
And they've done about as good a job as they could do with that. All but one of the candidates so far has maxed out on their democracy voucher donations, mm-hmm. which is a good sign.
Yeah. But then we start looking at the outside finance.
Yeah.
The PAC funding. There's been a total in the city council races. There's been a total of $8,154,838 in PAC funding in the local elections. So not just city council, but also other elections, but the bulk of that money has been for the city council elections.
And I would say, with the exception of Ann Sattler Davidson, all of those other candidates traditionally, you know, $180,000, $240,000, certainly the District 3 candidates would have raised enough money to be considered competitive, they can get out their message to their districts.
Yeah, and I would say most of them are raising more than past candidates have in district races. Now, that PAC funding, that $8 million of PAC funding, that's almost double of what all the candidates in the city council races have raised put together. And that includes candidates in the primary that have all been, you know, knocked out. And some of them raise significant amounts as well. Now, the list of major PACs that have been raising and spending money in the city, at least in the city council races, at the top of that list is the Civic Alliance for a Sound Economy. They go by the acronym CASE. They're the Seattle Chamber of Commerce supported PAC.
And that's where Amazon has been funneling a lot of their money.
Yeah, they've raised a total of $2.6 million.
And their byline for both the Twitter and Facebook account for the PAC
for CASE
is Seattle, we deserve better.
Which is true.
We do, don't we?
Just wondering who the we is there.
Yeah.
And exactly how much they think they deserve more than they've already got.
Yeah. Yeah. And exactly how they define better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Of that $2.6 million that CASE has raised, $1.5 million has come from Amazon. So the vast majority of it. Other major donors to CASE include $235,000 from Vulcan, their number two, $145,000 from the Washington Association of Realtors, too. And other major contributors include Expedia, Hedrine Holdings, and the RC Hedrine Company, that's major real estate money, Starbucks, Boeing, Puget Sound Energy, Comcast, Lyft, Weyerhaeuser, Alaska Airlines, and the Washington Retail Association PAC, among other very large businesses.
Yeah. It's really a who's who, not just of businesses in Seattle, but large multinational businesses that have an interest in Seattle.
Yeah. So far, CASE has spent about $1.3 million supporting their selection of candidates with... about another million on hand after you look at debts.
They have actually $1.4
million. Well, yeah, they've got about $0.4 million in debts that they have to pay, mm-hmm. too. So that leaves them with about $1 million in cash on hand to support their selection of candidates.
With 11 days left in the race.
Yeah. And their candidates, in order of who they've spent the most money on to least, are Heidi Wills, Jim Pugel, Phil Tavel, Egan O'Ryan, Mark Solomon, and Deborah Juarez. They are clearly not a fan of Ann Davison Sadler.
No. And
I can't imagine who would be.
Wills has gotten $645,000 from Case,
yes.
Which really surprises me quite a bit. It makes me wonder what she's been telling them and how little she learned from her previous city council experience, where she got bounced off basically for taking money from the wrong people.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in the number two pack is People for Seattle. That's Tim Burgess's collection of rich friends. I call them rich people for Seattle. They've raised $587,205. And their contributors are very heavy on the CEOs, real estate developers, and venture capitalists who live within the city of Seattle, not donating from their companies, but donating as individuals to the PAC.
And a lot of the $300,000+ that Egan O'Ryan has gotten has been from senior Amazon executives. It's been very interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, Rich People for Seattle have spent heavily to support the same candidates as Case. So they don't have a whole lot of cash left in the last 10 to 11 days here, but they still have about $28,000 on hand that they can spend to buy radio ads, you know, banner advertisements in the Seattle Times,
yeah. Most of the media buys, it's too late. Those media buys have to have already been placed and paid for in order to run before November 5th.
Yeah, but there's still time.
Yeah. Well, primarily what they would be spending money on at this point is salary for paid, quote-unquote, volunteers to go door-to-door,
to do
phone calls, to get out the vote efforts.
Yeah.
So that's where that money is going to go.
Or do social media ad buys,
yes,
that kind of thing. Now, number three in the list is the group Unite Here Local 8. They've raised $521,183. Most of it has been spent to support Andrew Lewis in District 7, their labor organization. Number four on the list is the Civic Alliance for a Progressive Economy, sponsored by Working Washington. They've raised $454,109. Their top contributors are people like Nick Hanauer, the progressive rich guy, SEIU, United Food and Commercial Workers, and the Teamsters Local. So a whole lot of labor folks behind the Civic Alliance for a Progressive Economy. Their money has been spent to support, and this is in order of who they've spent the most on to least, Dan Strauss, Lisa Herbold, Tammy Morales, Sean Scott, and Shama Sawant. And they have not supported Andrew Lewis in District 7 because he's getting that massive amount of support from Unite Here Local 8.
Yeah. And that's really the only labor money that Sawant is getting.
Yeah. And if you add together these two big labor PACs, you get just under $1 million against the $2.6 million of Case, plus the, more than $500,000 from Rich People for Seattle and some other backers of Chamber of Commerce candidates, which I'll talk about next.
Yeah, and it was very odd to see Jason Rance, our one of our local hate radio personalities on Cairo, go on Tucker Carlson on Fox News this week and basically make the case that the city council raises are being flooded by labor money. He didn't mention at all any of the corporate money that's coming in, and spent a lot of time talking about how Lisa Herbold wants to abolish the navigation teams, which is totally incorrect. But he has a weird obsession with Lisa Herbold. So that was one of several.
Saying that labor money has flooded the city council races is and then ignoring the fact that the Chamber of Commerce and their friends have spent three times that amount is pretty dishonest.
And the big business money that's going into the council races has also been the subject of a lot of national coverage.
It has been.
I'll get to that in a minute, too.
So we're in the limelight here, or I should say in the spotlight here in our local races, particularly our city council races. Now, number five on the list of PACs is the Seattle Firefighters PAC. They've raised $258,512 to support primarily Egan O'Ryan, Mark Solomon, Alex Peterson, Deborah Juarez, and Heidi Wills. Again, in this case, you would expect the Seattle Firefighters to support labor candidates, but no, they're supporting the big Chamber of Commerce candidates, which I find quite puzzling. Now, number six on the list is Moms for Seattle, which I refer to as Rich Moms for Seattle. They're essentially the I'm married to a CEO women, but there are also men who have donated to Rich Moms for Seattle. They've raised $236,132. They raised most of their money and spent most of it before the primary, but they still have about $25,000 on hand to spend in the next 10 to 11 days. So far, they've spent money on Phil Tavel, Heidi Wills, and Jim Pugel since the primaries. Those are their three main candidates. And fortunately, their other main candidates didn't make the cut in the primaries, including the right-wing candidate Pat Murakami and in District 2. And the
darling... That was District 3.
Yeah,
Ari Hoffman was
yeah,
in District 2.
District 3. Ari Hoffman in District 2, and the darling of real estate developers, Michael George, in District 7. Not George Michael, not the wake me up before you go guy, but Michael George.
He's not running.
He's not running this
round. No.
Yeah, he didn't make it through the primaries.
No, he had a careless whisper.
So there was some other election news this week as well. Egan O'Brien is going to have to pay a $1,000 fine to the city of Seattle.
That'll hurt.
For a campaign violation for an ad he placed in The Stranger that lacked the name of the sponsor. The ad was a two-page wraparound false cover for The Stranger's election endorsements issue. It featured a copy of The Stranger's cover with one-third of the cover page below the fold devoted to an ad for Egan O'Brien that made it look like The Stranger was actually endorsing him, even though, if you read the issue, The Stranger endorsed Shama Sawant in District 3.
Yeah, I covered
3.
That at length a couple weeks ago.
Now, O'Brien was turned in by a member of The Stranger's own staff, digital editor Chase Burns, who filed a complaint with the city's Ethics and Elections Commission. Now, on the other hand, it appears that everyone in The Stranger's advertising department was perfectly okay with that ad. And I think this points to a major problem with newspapers taking advertisements from candidates, especially in the same issue where they do their election endorsements.
Yeah, they do a lot of different. I mean, Sawant had an ad in that issue too.
Mm-hmm.
But the job of sort of reconciling the editorial and advertising content like that would fall to the publisher, Tim Keck, and obviously he let that slide. And The Stranger got a lot of blowback for it.
Yeah, I think they have a different publisher now. I don't mm-hmm. think it's Tim Keck anymore. But the publisher appeared to be supportive of the digital editor's complaint. So it kind of made me wonder who's running the show and who's overseeing things at The Stranger, that they would take an ad like that that is misleading as well as a campaign violation.
But now, either way, the penalties both for O'Brien and The Stranger are minimal.
Are minimal at this point, which I also find
offensive. And O'Brien got into some other trouble this week, too.
Yeah. He may have committed another campaign violation, according to local reporter Erica Barnett, who writes the blog entitled The Sea is for Crank. O'Brien's campaign office is in a building owned by Ian Eisenberg, who owns Uncle Ike's Pot Shop. Now, apparently, Eisenberg is letting O'Brien use that space rent-free, which is considered an in-kind contribution to Egan O'Brien's campaign. But O'Brien has not reported any in-kind contributions from Eisenberg in his SEC filings, which is a violation of state campaign finance laws. Erica Barnett points out that in-kind contributions are limited to $250 for candidates who receive democracy vouchers, as O'Brien does. And the value of rent on this building is obviously going to be much more than $250. And he's been there
every month.
Yeah, and he's been there since September. So O'Brien either needs to pay rent and report that as an expenditure, or he would possibly pay fines for not reporting an in-kind contribution and taking a contribution that's more than the limit allowed by city laws. Again, it would be interesting to see if he decides not to pay rent. Just how much the city would fine him.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be doing the math on that to figure out which is cheaper, the fine or the rent.
Yeah, and they'll probably decide to take the fine. Now, also in election news this week, Teresa Mosqueda and Lorena Gonzalez, the only two city council candidates not up for re-election this year, have finally decided to endorse Shama Sawant in District 3. For the primary, they endorsed her opponent, Zachary DeWolf, who didn't make it through the primary. And then they initially decided to sit out the final. But it was Amazon's $1 million donation to CASE, the PAC, the big Chamber of Commerce PAC, that finally woke them up to what big business is trying to do in buying city council seats in Seattle. And, you know, I just have to say, well, you know, welcome to the party, ladies.
Yeah. Or maybe they took a close look at Egan O'Ryan and realized he really wasn't cut out for city council.
Yeah. Well, and maybe they're just a little bit worried about their own reelection campaigns in 2021, whether they'll get real support from other city endorsements from other city council members if they decide to sit this one out.
And I would there was one other election, finance fundraising violation thing that came to light this week. Heidi Wills is facing a campaign complaint over failing to report the in-kind cost of a fundraiser at a Ballard Hotel. Again, she's kind of sloppy on these kind of details, and that got her into trouble 20 years ago. She doesn't seem to have learned much from that experience.
Yeah, that's my main issue with Heidi Wills is, can she learn from her past experiences? I think that leads us into, did you have anything else on election news, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to take a note that both election city council races did go national this week. The Amazon donation was featured in the New York Times, The Nation. Both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren came out in support of the progressive candidates in Seattle because of that.
Lisa Herbold, Tammy Morales, yes. Shama Sawant, Sean Scott.
As well as former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. Also weighed in on the races. And it should be noted also that Andrew Lewis is a former student of Reich, so he has a personal connection to the city council races.
Right.
And I think that had more to do with the two endorsements that Maria just talked about actually than the money itself. I think it was the national attention that actually motivated them more to step in and throw their endorsements. That's just my opinion. But
yeah, sure.
You think so?
And then there's also been this odd controversy.
That would
with,
make sense for Lorena Gonzalez in particular.
Yeah. And particularly since she wanted to become Attorney General before Bob Ferguson decided
ambitious.
Not to run for governor. So she has her eye on higher office and the fundraising base for that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
One other odd little controversy that Egan O'Ryan has run into this past couple weeks has to do with a Facebook post that he made last year seeking an egg donor and a surrogate mother, which for gay men is not unusual these days. But the wording of his post was very oddly specific in terms of the ethnicity that he wanted the surrogate mother to be. He had a whole laundry list of ethnicities that would be acceptable. It was very oddly...
Which he summed up as United Colors of Benetton.
Yes, which is means nothing to anybody under the age of 40, but anyone over the age of 40 tells you where he's coming from in terms of privilege. And it's worth noting that that surrogate process also costs between $100,000 and $200,000. So Orion's not hurting for his own money either. And there's an issue of class there in that race as well as race. After that post got some media attention and blowback, he came out with an additional post clarifying that his partner at the time was Mexican, and that's why they had... listed all those different United Colors of Benetton that they have since broken up, but he is still looking for a surrogate mother. But that had some blowback, and then overnight last night there were a number of.
I find it kind of interesting too the desire for I don't know, this is just me, but this desire to purchase a child and. With your, donate your own genes to it when, you could find a lot of children of color waiting for adoption.
Yeah. And ICE is offering quite a few right now.
Yeah. And, you might find that much more rewarding in some sense, rather than just sitting around waiting for the right woman to show up to host your child. It might be a little more generous to be looking at children that need adoption.
I think Orion really wants his own genes to be passed on.
Yeah, I think so too. I find that very egotistical, actually.
Yeah, yes.
But yes.
And then there was a minor kerfuffle overnight where a number of Sawant yard signs on MLK Boulevard were spray painted with an obscenity that I can't repeat on the air, but that a lot of families drove past and had to explain to their kids this morning. That probably came from some of the more right-wing enthusiastic backers of Orion, but it is a kind of a sad commentary on how divisive these races have become and how much emotion is being invested in them. A lot of people who are backing Orion really, really hate Sawant, and Sawant backers really aren't that fond of Orion at this point either. And we're seeing some of that kind of division in some of these other races as well, but particularly that one seems emotionally charged.
Yeah. So I just wanted to talk about my own analysis of the city council candidates and who I think is the most progressive. I do agree with Jav on most of them. For District 1, incumbent Lisa Herbold is far more progressive than Phil Tavel, whose main backers include real estate developers and strip club owners, one of whom was married to an associate of Frank Colacurcio Sr. I find it interesting that that's not made the news in this race. Now, in District,
I wonder if Wills has noticed.
Yeah, I don't know. In District 2, the more progressive candidate is longtime district activist Tammy Morales, not the Seattle Police Department employee and former security consultant Mark Solomon, even though he has a lot of support of mainstream sort of conservative Democrats in the state. Tammy Morales is the one to vote for if you want to elect a progressive person in District 2.
And she was endorsed early on by Pramila Jayapal, and that helped her a lot, too.
Yeah, the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party supports her. Now, District 3, incumbent Shama Sawant is the more progressive one, obviously. We've been talking about that quite a bit today. Not Egan Orion, whose backers include a who's who of corporate Seattleites, real estate developers, and, as Jav mentioned, a lot of Amazon employees, especially Amazon executives, as well as direct support from Amazon itself through the Chamber of Commerce PAC. District 4, the progressive candidate there is activist Sean Scott, not Alex Peterson, Tim Burgess's former aide and a former employee of Bank of America, Alliant Asset Management, and the global real estate services company, the giant CBRE. His biggest backers are real estate developers, property owners, and employees of Amazon and Microsoft, which is why I find it quite interesting that there are folks in the university district who are progressives who support Alex Peterson. I think they're making a mistake there. In District 5, I would urge people who live in District 5 to hold your nose and vote for the incumbent Deborah Juarez, because Ann Davison Sattler is a neighborhood NIMBY nightmare.
She is grossly unqualified for city council, in my opinion.
District 6, Dan Strauss. I've been hearing good things about him from people who have worked with him. He is the more progressive candidate in this race, and I would urge people, please don't vote for Heidi Wills, who is somehow more clueless now than she was the first time around. She's also one of Mayor Jenny Durkin's biggest fans. She wants to double the size of the navigation team, and she wants to build the missing link for the Burke-Gilman Trail, get this, as an elevated path like the High Line in New York City, which I think just really proves how gullible and kind of dumb she is. Because anybody who's read anything about the High Line in New York City, even two sentences about the High Line in New York City, knows that it was converted into a park from a pre-existing elevated railway. It was not built from scratch by the city as a park. And, of course,
Which would be hugely expensive.
Yeah, Heidi Wills doesn't know that. And she thinks, well, if they can do it in New York, they can do it in Seattle, you know. And I just have to say, no, I mean, that's just a classic example of how kind of stupid Heidi Wills is. In District 7, this is where I depart from Jav. He supports Andrew Lewis, and a lot of progressives support Andrew Lewis. I actually support Jim Pugel. And I know that's controversial, and I know Andrew Lewis has great progressive credentials and values, but he's very young, and he's not as familiar with Seattle politics and the issues as Jim Pugel is. I think a classic example of this is he doesn't know nearly as much about the history of police reform in Seattle as a candidate who is running for city council should. Pugel has been front and center in that, and he was part of he was one of the folks who was trying to push police reform when he was chief of police.
Yeah, now, and actually got pushed out for that reason.
Yeah, he also supports some really great policies, like a capital gains tax to pay for affordable housing. He supports needle exchanges and drug diversion programs, which he worked to implement the LEAD program in the Seattle Police Department when he was there. And he's great on transportation issues, which are at the core of District 7 concerns. And I think more than any other candidate in the city council races, he really understands the struggle to make the Seattle Police Department adhere to constitutional policing. And he's one of the few candidates to actually talk about or even mention that. So I find him to be a much better candidate. I think in about 10 years' time, Andrew Lewis would be great as if he stays in Seattle and continues to work on Seattle politics and just gets the experience and gets some more knowledge about some of these issues. Now, I think the real reason why Case and the Chamber of Commerce support Pugel is because all of the labor groups and the labor money that has gone into Andrew Lewis's campaign, I think it's a knee-jerk support of the opponent to someone who is so heavily supported by labor. But I don't see Pugel as an automatic vote against labor issues, like, for example, Egan O'Ryan would be, or Phil Tavel, maybe.
Egan O'Ryan, incidentally, has no opinion on police reform. He really hasn't studied it.
And he hasn't studied it, doesn't know. And, I mean, you see that over and over again with these candidates in city council races. Andrew Lewis said, well, I haven't really studied it. That, to me, that's a disqualifier. You know, I live in District 7. I'm voting in District 7. I'm voting for Jim Pugel because, you know, you can't run for city council and not know anything about the police reform process. I'm sorry. You know? But I think if Andrew Lewis had been living here for the last 10 years, he would be familiar with it. He's been, you know, studying, going to school. He's still fairly young. He's just pretty new still to Seattle politics.
It's interesting, too, that Jim Pugel did not get SPOG support on his campaign.
He did not get support from the Seattle Police Officers Guild. And I found that very interesting, too. And that has also made me think that, yeah, maybe he is the guy for District 7.
I think that those two candidates in District 7, as a collective, are better qualified for city council than any other two candidates.
Just about all the other candidates who are not incumbents. Yeah. I think that's why I was very happy with the results of the primary in District 7. I was like, we got the best two candidates in my district.
Yeah, and you know, my disclaimer,
which was a surprise for me.
My disclaimer there is that I know Andrew Lewis personally, and I think very highly of him. But
But
Pugel is well qualified as well.
That's not to say Andrew Lewis couldn't learn on the job. He probably could learn very quickly, and perhaps much more quickly than some of the other candidates, particularly Heidi Wills. You know, but I think I would like to go with the candidate who's set out of the gate and knows this stuff already. And that's Jim Pugel.
Okay. Did you want to weigh in on any of the ballot measures or any of the other?
No, that's fine. I trust you on those.
Okay. And I'll post my recommendations on Facebook again this weekend for folks who missed them the first time around.
All right. So, anything else on the local elections, or do we move on to national?
Let's move on to national.
Let's move on to national.
Okay. Okay, Jeff. Right.
There's a couple more things happening in D.C. this week.
Yeah, a major court ruling yesterday. Beryl Howell, the chief judge of the Federal District Court in D.C., rejected the White House's contention that the impeachment inquiry is de facto illegal. And she also, in the process, in her 75-page ruling, rejected the White House's contention that the president could not be investigated or let alone charged, which is something that the Department of Justice has been arguing in a number of court cases. Her ruling was fairly blistering. In rejecting the idea that the impeachment inquiry is illegal, she dismissed it with three words: the DOJ is wrong, which is probably the shortest sentence a federal judge has ever written.
Well, and keep in mind, too, the DOJ has been withholding all materials that they can and advising witnesses not to testify to any of the House committees that are investigating Trump. And that I think that's what she had in mind when she said the DOJ is wrong. I think she was including all that in there. Her ruling also covered telling the grand jury that they must release the materials from the Mueller investigation, must be disclosed to the House Judiciary Committee by next Wednesday. So she set that deadline and said, okay, give them the material they want.
And
withhold it.
And her ruling on that was a specific rejection of the Republican insistence.
Argument, yeah.
That impeachment was not legal unless the full House voted on it.
Yes.
Her quote on that was that that contention was, quote, cherry-picked and incomplete with no textual support in the U.S. Constitution, the rules of the House, or Rule 6E, which is the rule governing the release of grand jury material to Congress. So that was the piece that compels the DOJ to hand over the not just the unredacted Mueller report, but also the grand jury material that was used to support that.
Witness testimony and so forth. Yeah.
And she, in footnotes, raised a couple of interesting hints of what might be in those in that grand jury material. She made mention of evidence that Trump had advanced knowledge of the 2016 Russian interference in the election, and also that he had advanced knowledge of the timing of leaking of hacked DNC emails. Now, remember that those emails were released to WikiLeaks literally an hour after the Access Hollywood tape made the news, in direct response to that to try and control the news cycle. So if Trump had advanced knowledge of that, it was either very quick or they had an advanced plan to release it in a bad news day, bad news cycle. So that was that is potentially explosive. It's likely this ruling will be appealed, but her ruling was very strong and very well supported, and it seems unlikely that higher courts, including the Supreme Court, would overturn her ruling.
Or even take it up. They could just throw it out and say we're not hearing it.
At some point, we're going to see that stuff. Similarly, at some point, we're going to see the transcripts of the depositions that the House Intelligence Committee has been taking these last couple weeks. Chair Adam Schiff said he hoped to have those released by mid-November. So this is moving very quickly, and the news that's coming down the pike is unlikely to be favorable to the Trump administration.
Yeah. Now, also this week in the impeachment news, William B. Taylor's testimony that got
went off like a bomb.
Yeah, and even Trump's attempts to try to derail the media coverage of it didn't work. And I just want to recite a quote from his testimony.
Well, it wasn't his testimony; it was his opening statement.
Yeah, quote, in August and September of this year, I became increasingly concerned that our relationship with Ukraine was being fundamentally undermined by an irregular, informal channel of U.S. policymaking and by the withholding of vital security assistance for domestic political reasons. That was part of his opening statement. Now, Taylor wasn't talking just about the $391 million in military aid. He said Trump was trying to condition the entire U.S. relationship with Ukraine on getting a public promise from the Ukrainian president that he'd investigate Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, and a discredited right-wing conspiracy theory about the DNC servers and the Ukraine.
Which would exonerate Russia in 2016.
Yeah.
And that's the whole point.
Yeah. Now, Taylor kept very detailed notes, and he shared them with the committee, citing multiple sources in the Trump administration who could support his statements. Now, don't forget, Taylor is the man that Trump begged to come out of retirement in June to serve as ambassador to the Ukraine. Taylor had only been in the job for 4 months.
And that was because the previous ambassador had been forced out.
Yeah, forced out by Trump. And Taylor was clearly appalled at the state of U.S.-Ukraine relations when he took the job in June. Now, he also said that the entire national security team was opposed to withholding the aid, including the State Department, the Department of Defense, and John Bolton, the national security advisor at the time.
Who is now negotiating to testify to the Intelligence Committee as well.
Yeah, yeah. Taylor also talked about a discussion he had with Ukrainian National Security Advisor who told him that President Volodymyr Zelensky didn't want to, quote, be used as a pawn in a U.S. reelection campaign, end quote. So clearly the Ukrainians knew what was going on and what was up. Now, I just want to remind people, the irregular channel that Taylor mentions in his quote is made up of four people working outside of formal State Department channels, according to Taylor. That's Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, Special Envoy, Kurt Volker, and Energy Secretary Rick Perry, who got involved because, well, you know, oil, right?
Yeah. Well, natural gas in this case.
Yeah.
And it's important to note that both Volker and Perry have since resigned.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Now,
the important part of those names is that Taylor testified in his opening statement that he was told by Sondland that Sondland was acting on the direct orders of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So it's a direct line to Trump, and it's a direct line to the quid pro quo that Trump has been denying exists.
And Sondland, in his testimony to the House, kept saying over and over again, "I don't remember, I don't remember, I don't remember," when asked about these specific things. So who are you going to believe, right?
Yeah.
Now, the New York Times also reported this week that the Ukraine knew about the aid freeze in early August, putting a direct lie to Trump's assertion that the Ukrainian president didn't even know the aid was frozen. So essentially saying, look, Trump was lying when he said that.
There's a shock.
Yeah, there's a shock. Now, the New York Times obtained documents and interviewed government staff who verified that the Ukrainians were informed of the freeze in the first week of August and told to discuss it with Trump's acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney. Mulvaney has let slip in a recent press conference that, yes, the aid was frozen specifically to get a promise from the Ukrainian president that he'd investigate the Bidens. Mulvaney has tried to walk that back, but has been unsuccessful so far, and his original comments are still on the record. Now, the New York Times also reported that after the Ukrainian government was notified of the aid freeze, Gordon Sondland, Kurt Volker, and Rudy Giuliani got together to draft a statement for the Ukrainian president to deliver on CNN about investigating the Bidens.
Yes, and it was very important to Trump that Zelensky do that on American media, because what's the point of investigating the Bidens if nobody knows about it?
Right. Now, in the meantime, as Job said, Chief U.S. District Court Judge Beryl Howell has now ordered the release of the grand jury materials to the House Judiciary Committee by next Wednesday.
Yes, and
on the Mueller investigation.
Yes, and I expect it to be appealed before then. Yeah. But one other thing on that grand jury order is that the White House has stated and written, and at this point the White House counsel's memo demanding that executive branch people not cooperate with the congressional impeachment inquiry worked against them in Howell's ruling, saying Howell saying that the White House's stated policy of non-cooperation weighs heavily in favor of disclosure of the grand jury materials. Congress's need to access the grand jury material is heightened when the executive branch willfully obstructs channels to accessing other relevant evidence.
Yeah.
And note
so
the word.
She's calling it obstruction of justice.
Yes, and that that may well find its way into an article of impeachment.
Yeah.
Because there's a federal judge saying that the Trump administration is obstructing a congressional inquiry.
Yeah, and not just any federal judge either. What I find notable about this is that Beryl Howell is Chief Justice of the Washington, D.C. Federal District Court. Judge Howell impanels grand juries and oversees the litigation for Washington, D.C. And this is the district where Mueller's grand jury worked. So she's overseen that as well.
And she's very well respected. And her,
very well respected.
Her rulings tend to stand in on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing that was added to the whole quid pro quo issue this week, NBC News reporting yesterday that at least three administration officials have independently acknowledged Trump's escalating demands for quid pro quos from the Ukraine in depositions to the Intelligence Committee. So not only was Trump demanding quid pro quos, but his demands got higher over time as they weren't being met by the Ukrainian government. From investigating the Bidens and trying to embrace this right-wing conspiracy theory that Ukraine somehow meddled in the 2016 election, and then withholding a White House visit from President Zelensky, and a couple other things that got thrown in there as well. This is sort of classic real estate negotiation. If you don't take my initial price, I'm going to raise the price. And that's the approach that Trump was taking to this, using U.S. government assets, in the case of the military aid,
as leverage
to basically extort the Ukrainian government for his own personal gain. And that is the core of the impeachment.
Sorry, when you said NBC, I laughed a little bit because I thought you were going to talk about incident with Rudy Giuliani apparently butt dialing a reporter
there. Twice. He did it twice.
He does that regularly, apparently.
Yeah.
Butt dials, texts things to people.
And the interesting thing, I listened to that audio, and it's not clear at that point whether Giuliani is talking his role as the lawyer to Ukrainian oligarch, the lawyer to President Trump, his own private businessman, or as an independent actor working as some sort of U.S. diplomat. He's mixing his roles in a way that is very dangerous and has already apparently landed him in hot water with the Southern District of New York, which is actively investigating him for potential legal violations as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on all that? I'm sure we'll have more next week.
There will be more.
Yep. Stay tuned.
I'm sure we'll have more for months and months and years. Moving on, some listings coming out for the upcoming Democratic debates.
Yeah, the November 20th debate, which is going to be held in Georgia, is sponsored by MSNBC and Washington Post. They announced their moderators this week are going to be all women. Rachel Maddow will be doing it for the second time. She was a moderator in June. Andrea Mitchell from NBC and Kristen Welker from NBC News, and then from the Washington Post, Ashley Parker. So those will be the moderators for the debate on November 20th. Now, the threshold for candidates to qualify to be on the stage has been raised to $165,000 donors, and 3% in four polls or 5% in two polls in the early states. Now, nine of the 12 that were on the stage last time qualified for the November debate, with Amy Klobuchar just meeting the qualifications just in the last couple of days. Three other candidates are still struggling to get back on the stage. That's Beto O'Rourke, Tulsi Gabbard, and Julian Castro, who mentioned this week that he might be dropping out of the race soon. The December debate is set for December 19th at UCLA. That's going to be hosted by PBS NewsHour and Politico. They have talked with the Democratic Campaign Committee, which is raising the qualifying criteria again for the December debate. They are going to require that candidates have at least 200,000 donors and meet one of two polling requirements, either 4% in four national polls or early state polls, or 6% in two polls in the four early states of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. And so far, only three candidates have met that requirement. That would be the top three: Warren, Biden, and Sanders.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with a meeting of minds between Mr. Putin and Mr. Erdogan.
And I think Donald Trump's ears were burning. They were laughing at him.
Yeah. Trump has really never met a dictator he didn't like. And that includes both Vladimir Putin and President Erdogan of Turkey.
And often those dictators have mastered the art of telling him what a genius he is.
Yeah, what a genius he is in return.
And then they'll do whatever they want, basically.
Yeah. And of course, I should add to that list Bashar al-Assad of Syria. This week, Putin and Erdogan, the president of Turkey, met at Putin's summer home in Sochi at his dacha to shake hands over an agreement on Turkish control of a swath of territory in northern Syria that had been under the control of Syrian Kurdish militias supported by the United States. Those militias were U.S. allies in the fight against the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq.
They were not anymore.
Yeah, they were also meant to potentially form part of a core of a democracy movement in Syria to oppose Bashar al-Assad. Now, Trump threw those allies under a bus on a whim during a phone call with the Turkish President Erdogan, in which Trump promised to withdraw all U.S. troops from Syria because, hey, why not? Let's just appease my favorite dictator of the moment.
Yeah, without consulting with his own military, with the State Department.
His own Department of Defense.
Or any European allies.
Yeah. Now, in fact, Trump hasn't withdrawn all troops from Syria, just the ones that kept Turkey from invading Syria and slaughtering the Kurds. There are still about 200 U.S. Special Operations Forces stationed in eastern Syria to keep control of Syria's oil fields. And that makes Trump's priorities really clear. He can protect oil fields coveted by Western oil companies, but he's not going to protect our allies.
He also suggested that the Kurds move to those oil fields, which is hundreds of miles from where they have been living, from their homes.
Yeah.
And there's primarily Arabs living there now who won't necessarily welcome them.
Yeah.
They're a persecuted minority, you know, that still stands. But the U.S. policy of advocating regime change in Syria to try and get rid of the dictator Assad also seems to have been standing
been
on its
thrown
head.
Under the bus as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, by Trump's whim, essentially.
Yeah. And any idea that the Kurds might have of eventually having a homeland, because, of course, the Kurds are the largest ethnic group in the world to lack their own autonomous nation state, have been dashed by this as well. Now, for protection, the Kurds have had to cut a new deal with Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. And that has allowed Assad's military to reoccupy most of northern Syria, large pieces of territory that they had lost to what the Obama administration had hoped would be the beginnings of a democracy movement in Syria. In essence, the Syrian democracy movement now is dead. Bashar al-Assad is as strong as he ever was, and Russian President Vladimir Putin, who supported Assad with weapons and an aerial bombing campaign, gets to look like a peacemaker.
And it gives Russia outsized influence in Syria, which they really want. They have a naval base there. It's their access to ice-free port in the Mediterranean. So Syria is strategically important to the Russians, and it gives an entire swath with Russia, Iran, the Kurds, who are now allied with Assad rather than the U.S., and Assad himself, that is hostile to the U.S. in that region, which can't be good.
Yeah, in addition, Putin has been making friends with Saudi Arabia and with the other big U.S. ally in the Middle East, Israel.
And that seems to be, what Trump wants, because whatever Putin wants, Trump wants.
Trump wants, yeah.
It's remarkable how every foreign policy decision Trump makes benefits Russia.
Yeah, so if Donald Trump wanted to prove that he's not a Russian puppet, this is not the way to do it.
No.
For sure.
But, he seems to have this vision of replacing the Atlantic alliance that has basically been in place since World War II with an alliance of great powers, the United States, China, Russia, that are all dictatorships.
Well, not necessarily China, because he has a lot of Chinese critics in his cabinet, but I'm sure he would love to be the co-strongman of the world with Vladimir Putin.
Yes, and Xi as well. He said very positive things about Xi a number of times, but he's still initiated this trade war, which is basically not only hurting the Chinese economy, it's
also
very much hurting
the
American
US
economy.
As well, the global economy.
The global economy, but particularly farms and the manufacturing sector. And we're starting to see those numbers in U.S. economic reports. It doesn't bode well for 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been affecting farmers here in Washington State.
Yep, absolutely.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Washington State as a coastal state is heavily dependent on export and trade, and our economy,
particularly to China.
Yeah, and our economy is suffering because of the trade war that Donald Trump is undertaking.
Yeah, you can see at the Port of Seattle the reduced traffic, that there's not as many particularly East Asian shipping containers and ships going in.
Imports or exports.
Yeah. It's having an impact for sure.
All right. Events.
Yeah, several coming up this week. On Tuesday evening, October 29th at 7:30, there's the Global Battle Against Disinformation. That'll be with Richard Stengel. That's $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle. And then the following night on Wednesday, October 30th, also at Town Hall, the awesome Community Alliance for Global Justice is presenting the Battle for the Future of Food in Africa, with Timothy A. Wise and Milan Belay, and also $5 at Town Hall 8th and Seneca. And that presentation is not just about Africa. It's about the struggle in the wake of climate change to feed the world's population in the coming decades. It's and to avoid corporatization of the food supply in the world. So that that's a definitely a huge issue.
That looks like a really good
that
event.
That isn't yeah. getting much attention. So it it looks like a great event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the big push for major corporate controlled agriculture in Africa and the pushback there with which again the AGRA, the people for the hosting group that CAGJ,
the Community Alliance for Global Justice.
Thank you. The issue they've been covering for so long about that the farmers there already know what the solution is and how to grow food for everybody.
And
things like the Gates Foundation that are pushing these
things like allowing indigenous farmers who don't have title to land because people don't. Under a system that's tribal and not capitalist, people don't have land titles. They often get pushed off the land in order to sell it to large corporations
to buy the seeds they've always used because they're now patented by Western corporations.
Yeah, turn them into farms to grow things for export, like coffee, for example, rather than growing food for the local community. These individual indigenous farmers, they know what crops grow best, and they know how to produce food, and they know what the climate cycles are, and so forth. And
or
they
at
know
least what they were.
They know how to nourish and conserve the land. And if they had more support from the government, from their own governments, then they would be able to thrive. But that has not been the case.
And international institutions like the IMF and World Bank,
or
as well.
International institutions could just stay out of it.
Yeah. And one of the impacts of the trade war with China also is that it's impacting family farmers much more than it's impacting big agribusiness because they have the deep pockets to survive the trade war, and whereas family farmers don't necessarily, and they're getting hurt in the middle part of this country by we've lost a lot of crops this year by record rains. So
yeah, there are not that many family farmers remaining in the United States, but the ones that are remaining are finding it really, really difficult to survive the Trump administration. And that's a real issue.
Yeah.
So in addition to that event that's happening next Wednesday at Town Hall at 7:30 p.m., there's the Community Alliance for Global Justice is connected to that, is doing a rally in solidarity with African food sovereignty movement and people in front of the Gates Foundation. They're doing that from 12 to 1 p.m. because, again, the Gates Foundation has been our local engine for driving so much of these attempted changes in Africa. So
These attempted changes, which would set up these large farms for growing export foods and so forth, rather than helping local farmers there strengthen their position and grow food for their local populations.
So, yeah, and Africa has the second largest population of any continent in the world after Asia. It really is a major issue in terms of food security.
It's also ground zero for climate change.
Absolutely.
Too. So with things like desertification and the changing rainfall patterns in the Sahel.
There's been serious droughts in the Congo and other places in Central Africa this past year.
It's also got the second largest amount of U.S. Special Forces operations going on there. And a major
drone base.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, actually a couple now. Got to hear Nick Terse speak this week talking about that, which will be airing here in the coming week or two. Mm-hmm. So, this, as we regularly state, it's all connected.
Which is why you should support KODX, listener-supported, volunteer-run, because we bring you these kind of awesome pieces of information.
And discussion, yeah. So if you want to support us, please go to our website online, kodxseattle.org. There's a Patreon button at the top. At the bottom, there's a PayPal button for you to make donations online. Or you can send us a check. Make out your check to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail it to
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And you can find that information on the website.
As well.
So, all right. And then, of course, just a number of days away from the election.
Yep. So get your ballots in by November 5th, but the earlier you can get them in, the better. Mm-hmm.
Although there's, as I found this week, by hanging on for another, you know, week, you get all these other exciting pieces of information coming in.
You do.
That's
you
why
do,
I always drag my feet.
But don't mail it on the day of. No, mail it a day or two before.
Get
it,
yeah. Get there in
and,
time.
And information doesn't necessarily mean truthful information.
Yeah. Well,
it is, after all, legal in Washington State to lie in the course of an election.
Yeah, so do your own research.
As we've
Make up your own mind and make sure you vote.
Yep. Yes. Because it really matters this time around.
It does.
Yeah, I think this is the single most important city election in my lifetime happening.
Yep, I would agree.
Right now, mm-hmm. So, all right, so hopefully you'll both be back next week. Is that the plan?
That's the plan.
That is the plan.
Okay.